Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Today on the show, a conversation with Michael Cruz, senior staff writer at Politico. Michael has a long, distinguished journalism career. Before Politico, he was an enterprise reporter at the Tampa Bay Times and Times Herald Record in upstate New York. He's also written for Our State Magazine, Charlotte Magazine, Outside Magazine, Grantland, rest in peace, and Basketball America, also rest in peace. He's also a proud graduate of Davidson College. Michael Cruz, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you, Dave.
So, along with many others at Politico, you've sort of been on the Donald Trump beat of late. Not so much following him around. I'm sure that would take a certain amount of whatever out of you to do that. But
yeah, thank goodness.
But you've been taking these sort of deep dives, focusing on specific time periods in his life and relationships with certain people to try to help explain who Trump is and how he appeals to some and doesn't appeal to others. And your latest over the weekend was called The Trouble with Peak Trump. Now, explain to me what peak Trump is and why maybe what is the trouble with him being in peak Trump?
Sure. So, you know, over this last almost year and a half, what we've learned about Donald Trump is actually not that much, or at least not much new if you've been paying attention and have read the books about him and even the books by him or by ghostwriters. He has been, throughout this campaign, throughout these 16 months, precisely the person he has been always, his entire life, a narcissist, megalomaniac, self-absorbed, self-delusional, you know, an entitled rich kid who blames everybody else and every other thing but himself when things go wrong. And things do go wrong, and here's where you sort of get to peak Trump. They always go wrong, always and inevitably, because even though he has been privileged enough and is intelligent enough and in his own, you know, peculiar way, focused enough and single-minded enough to climb to the tops of mountains, the weight of his ego always brings him down. And this has happened three times very clearly. In the late 80s, he in the aftermath of the success, surprising success of The Art of the Deal, was in a position to go on an absolute spending spree, which he did, purchased another casino in Atlantic City, purchased the Plaza Hotel, bought a yacht he didn't need or didn't even really like. And this very quickly, I mean, within a couple years, led to you know, $3 billion of debt and near financial ruin. In the middle of the 2000s, he was, again, sort of remarkably on top of the world thanks to The Apprentice. And he did what he does. He his ego led him to do things and say things that didn't hurt him as quickly as they did in the late 80s and early 90s. But it is in this time when he created the Billy Bush Access Hollywood tape. It is in this time when he allegedly committed some of the instances of sexual harassment and sexual assault, and these things, it took running for president for these private things to become public, but ultimately they did.
So I'm wondering if you can go back sort of to when you've been at Politico a little while, and I don't know if it was a conversation between you and an editor or if it was your idea, but I'm curious, like, when you first got sort of this assignment to follow Trump in the way you have with these sort of longer form pieces, did that idea excite you? Were you interested in this topic beforehand, or him particularly beforehand? And how's it been sort of covering him this particular way?
So there are sort of two phases for me. Early on, I covered him in a way that admittedly and kind of regrettably felt a little bit like a sidelight. You know, I was more focused in, I'm thinking of middle of 2015, even into sort of fall, Thanksgiving of 2015, did a few things on Trump, but was more focused, frankly, on Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz. Those seemed like the better picks. And one thing I've learned doing this sort of work with out and try to identify potential winners, and those are the folks that you spend the most resources on, both as a company and as an individual. You know, there are only so many hours in the day. But I would say that particularly after Christmas of 2015, I came back from a short break and I said to my editor, what if I just really sort of focused on Trump? Because, you know, until proven otherwise, he is going to be the nominee. And, you know, that was, a month or so before Iowa, more than a month before New Hampshire and onward. But it seemed as if he was polling consistently within the Republican electorate as the favorite. Beyond that, though, he is just, say what you want about him, but he is a fascinating guy who has lived this exceptionally public life for a long, long time. And there were so many places, from my standpoint, doing what I am tasked to do at Politico, there were so many places to plug into and to look at and to report out. And so it really sort of started to take off, I'd say, post-New Hampshire, the first 3 or 4 weeks of this calendar year. I did something on Rubio. I was doing some things on Cruz, but I remember sort of transitioning right around New Hampshire, being in New Hampshire, and focusing fairly exclusively on Trump. And the only person I've written about really over the last 8-9 months, not named Donald Trump, is of course Hillary Clinton, although I've done much more on Trump than Clinton, for better or for worse.
As someone who is chronicling sort of this individual at sort of a unique time, excuse me, what I'm assuming you haven't met him, just from the ways you, the ways you've written about him, it doesn't seem like you've met him. Is that right?
That's right. I've never met him. We had a phone conversation fairly early on, probably in January or early February. We had a phone conversation that was literally 6 minutes long. Ever since, for most stories, I'm in communication with the campaign, but in, I would say, a fairly nominal way. The kinds of conversations I need to have are best had with people who are not Donald Trump.
Right.
And people who are, frankly, not even involved currently with the campaign. You know, keep in touch with some people who have been involved with the campaign and who are no longer in a more background capacity. But typically, my work, and this goes for people beyond Trump, too, my work is focused more on sort of where candidates have been rather than where they are. I live in a very strange space, sort of in books and in clips and on the phone and meeting with people here and there around the country who have had experiences with Trump. Honestly, my work doesn't need me to be in constant contact or almost any contact with the man himself.
So how has your opinion of him changed since, you know, you sort of started and kind of, you know, doing a lot of work on him, but then you've fully engaged really your professional life looking at Donald Trump? Has how you have viewed him or what your thoughts are on him changed at all during that process?
I think the more I've learned, the more certain ideas about him have solidified. You know, he is, for me, and I think for lots of people, a really, really interesting person to look at, in that he is a window into so many things that are important in American life over the last generation. The way he has not been a self-made man, but been a very self-made or self-created character is, I think, fascinating. He, of course, wants to be seen as a self-made man, but as the son of a very wealthy father, he had all sorts of advantages that others don't. But what he has done, and it's remarkable, is create this character that is Donald Trump. And this character has sort of rampaged through the American landscape for a while, and the way he has, in particular, used the available media to further his aims in this regard is worth studying, and I have studied it throughout a variety of my stories over the course of this year. But you know, he is proactively taking advantage of the beginning of kind of gossip media in the New York Tabs, New York Post, Page Six in particular, in the late 70s and early 80s. The rise of cable television is something he takes advantage of in the 80s and into the 90s and onward, of course. The rise of the internet, he has, in his own weird way, been very savvy about it. And savvy, I say weird way because he is a Luddite, a technophobe, I mean, a guy who basically doesn't use a computer, but he has understood sort of how to harness the media of the moment and continue to add to this character and then to leverage that attention into opportunity, into money, and into more attention. So sort of the Trump tornado is self-perpetuating. He always does, as we discussed, he always does seem to take it a little bit too far, at which point he is stopped or stops himself, if you want to look at it like that.
And obviously that appeal doesn't have, it's a two-way street. He has to appeal to somebody, and he obviously appeals to quite a few people. You know North Carolina well. You went to college here. You've lived here for a long time in different parts of your life. Who does he appeal to here in North Carolina, and why?
So, I mean, North Carolina is a swing state, obviously, because it's become even more so highly representative and microcosmic of the country as a whole. You have these educated, more upper income, more upwardly mobile, more densely populated blue islands, cities and areas immediately surrounding those cities, the Research Triangle, Charlotte, Asheville, et cetera. And then you have these, you know, seas of red, large geographical areas, but with relatively small or more dispersed populations. And it's been interesting for me, having recently moved back to North Carolina, taking some drives through more rural areas, and you are reminded that you see far more Trump signs out in those areas than you do Clinton signs, if you see any Clinton signs. And so I think the people that he is appealing to are, there are, and this goes for North Carolina, and it goes for other areas certainly as well, but there are, I think, two major stories about the 2016 campaign. And by major stories, I mean stories that will be relevant and resonant 50 years from now, 100 years from now, history books will be written. There's this societal split that Donald Trump, of all people, has brought to the fore, has taken advantage of, but has also really illuminated. If there are two Americas, it is not so much blue v. red or liberal v. conservative, but really haves and have-nots, and that goes beyond money or income. It is about education, the people who have the education to compete in the new, in many ways more challenging, more global economy, versus the people who don't and therefore can't or have a much harder time. And it's hard to talk about this without sounding a certain way, right? But the numbers of Trump supporters versus non-Trump supporters based on levels of educational attainment are stark, and that is not a D versus R thing. That is an R thing too, a Republican thing too. So the people who are mobile versus the people who are not, who are stuck at this challenging, ongoing tectonic plates juncture in the history of the economy in this country and beyond. I think that's where you see the divide. And so the people that Trump is appealing to, not only in North Carolina, but in so many places around this country, are the people who are angry and who are stuck and who are angry, justifiably angry. And I think we all knew that, but I don't think we knew the extent of it and the extent to which They feel left behind. I mean, even just using that word, they, feels a little bit uncomfortable, but the people who feel left behind are angry, and are so angry that they see a solution in a Manhattan-based member of the not only 1%, but a fraction of the 1%. So, I mean, so that's the first, I said there were two major stories. That's the first major story, and it's one that we've talked about a lot, maybe not enough, but a lot in this election, and it's one we'll talk about for years and for decades to come post November 8th. The second, not to get off the focus on Trump, but the second major story of 2016 to me is that Hillary Clinton will be, assuming things don't change here in the next 2 weeks, will be the first female president in the history of the United States. And that is the one of the two major stories of the 2016 election that far fewer people are talking about. But her election, if it goes this way on November 8th, will be by definition as historic as the election of Barack Obama was in 2008. And it will be, I think, even with all the reverberations of Trump and of Trumpism and of his supporters, it will be the story in the end of the election of 2016.
Michael Cruz, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michael Cruz is a senior staff writer at Politico. Thanks for listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play and listen to all of our politics stories on WUNC.org.